Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now it's that time of the month again when a fresh issue of Monocle magazine appears on newsstands around the world. Our citrus-coloured October issue is out now and contains our retail survey, a look at the architecture of prisons and a dinner I enjoyed with the advertising maestro John Hegarty at his French vineyard, Delicieux. But on the show, of course, we're concentrating on the culture section of the magazine, and this month's edition takes us from the Christian rock concerts of Nashville to the upstate New York home of British artist Gary Hume. I'll be chatting with the writers and photographers who have brought these stories to life. That's ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. The lead story in the October issue takes us to Nashville, where a new kind of church service is sweeping the city's Christian community and boosting record sales at the same time. Monocle's New York bureau chief headed to the Tennessee capital, where Christian rock, pop and rap concerts attract hundreds of worshippers every Sunday. And Ed joins us on the line from our New York bureau. Ed, thank you for your time this afternoon. Now, this is an interesting one. This is a story that actually kind of grew out of another story you're reporting for another part of the magazine. Tell us how the story Natalie headlined Deity Dancing came to be, or tell us the genesis, to use a biblical phrase, of this wonderful story.
Indeed. I mean, I was in Los Angeles doing another story, and I was at the Capitol Records building, and I was talking with the CEO there, and basically we were just talking about the label and the group, and he told me about, you know, one of their other labels that they have that's based in Nashville, Capitol Christian Music Group, that's responsible for over 40% of the world's Christian music output, which I kind of found fascinating, especially because, you know, you think of Nashville as being, you know, the heart of country music. And you may forget, if you don't live in the US or you haven't spent much time in Tennessee, that, you know, it is this very important buckle, if you like, in the Bible Belt. And there are churches all over town. They joke there that there's a church on every street corner, and it's kind of true. And I just thought it would be fascinating to kind of go there and not just report on Christian music generally, but also look at the way that there are a lot of more contemporary styles of Christian music, including pop and rock and even hip hop, that's kind of trying to appeal to this younger generation of churchgoers. And that, you know, that is a huge part of the population in the Bible Belt, you know, across America. There are lots of young, sort of well-dressed people who are flocking to churches, and they like to have music that represents them. And so there's this huge scene out there that if you're not particularly religious, you know nothing about. And I just thought it would be super interesting to go there and kind of shine a light on that scene.
It makes for a fascinating read. It's a great story. It's a gift for a writer, this kind of thing as well, isn't it, in a way? Because obviously the elephant in the room is, are these cool people? One of the questions we asked ourselves was, are they kind of pretending to be Christian so they can make it as a rock star when they might not make it as a non-Christian rock star? What did you make of those questions? And overall, what did you make of the vibe, actually, of these guys? Did they seem Christian first, or did they seem like musicians first?
I mean, this is one of the great things about being a journalist, isn't it? In a way, you get to be a part of and see things that you wouldn't necessarily do if you weren't writing a piece. You know, I got to go and be part of a 2-hour church service, and I was there.
You know, I thought that was your normal Sunday,
watching bands. Sadly, not in secular, sinful New York City, I'm afraid. But, you know, to be there kind of standing at the front and seeing everyone, you know, when I was there, there were literally people falling to their knees and rocking backwards and forwards in front of the stage in kind of ecstasy, almost pained ecstasy, as these musicians were playing. And there was a lot of, you know, hands raised with, you know, wobbly, shaky hands. And, you know, people were just so engaged. And I was just thinking, I don't think I ever get that emotional, but I almost felt like a slight imposter being part of the scene, but it was fascinating. I didn't quite know what to do with myself because, you know, I'm not, you know, religious, and obviously I told them that I wasn't particularly religious, but I was interested in, you know, learning more. But in the church services, the music is generally worship music. So that's bands that are basically singing praise of Jesus. And the lyrics are flashed up on the screen and essentially the whole congregation sings along. So I had to make a decision about whether I was going to sing along during this church service, which I did, but I don't know, I felt like people were going to think I was an imposter because I wasn't perhaps giving it my all compared to some of the people next to me. Everywhere I see it, everywhere I see it, can't help but believe it,
I can't help but believe it, everywhere I see it. And it's an interesting thing, I wonder whether, I mean, rock and roll music has been part of the mainstream, it hasn't been something rebellious for the best part of 30 years. I wonder if you feel it's more rebellious to actually be a Christian rocker than just a regular rocker. There's something, I mean, a lot of these people, as you said, came from very Christian families and they're kind of continuing the faith in every sense of that word. Did you get the feeling that somewhere along the road, some of those people actually were rebelling by being Christians rather than by being rockers?
Well, I think certainly if you look back to, say, the 70s, because, you know, before then, well, maybe the 60s is when it kind of first started coming in, this sort of music that was expressly to try and appeal to younger people. At the time then, the establishment, if you like, the church establishment was very against it. They thought kind of dancing and contemporary pop music and rock music and that sort of stuff was, you know, sinful. I use a quote in the article that talks about the devil beat. And even apparently, according to people I spoke to, the people at CCMG, you know, at the time, this sort of music, when it was being produced on, I guess, must have been cassette tape, was being sold under the counter at Christian bookstores because the people selling it were worried that their older clientele would stop shopping there if they saw they were selling this sort of sinful music. What's certainly true is that this scene and has come a long way since then, and it's, you know, widely accepted. And you have to break it down into brackets as well, because there are so many different types of Christian music. One thing that's interesting is that it's the only real music out there that gets put in a genre based on the lifestyle and the lyrical content. So Christian music can be anything. It just has to, you know, the musicians essentially have a clean living lifestyle and they talk about God or reference God or live life a certain way that makes it Christian music. But then at the same time, it can be anything from rock and pop to gospel to even hip hop. So I don't think nowadays it's necessarily that rebellious to do this. I think maybe the more traditional churches might not be as into it.
Roughly what percentage of the, say, the US music scene is made up of the Christian sector, whether that's, as you say, rock or hip-hop or pure pop music with a Christian bent? How important is it to the sort of health and welfare of the US music scene as a whole?
Well, it's around 3.5%, which may not sound like a huge amount, but it's actually more than jazz and Latin combined. So that gives you an idea. It is, one might say, niche, but it's more popular than many other niches if you look at that, you know, comparison. It's pretty steady. The number of churchgoers and people who call themselves Christians in the US is pretty steady. You know, like all music industries and sectors in the music industry, it suffered when streaming initially came in and, you know, CD sales went down. What's certainly true is that the demographic is slightly older, skews slightly older than some other music types. And so that sort of demographic has been slightly slower to adopt new ways of consuming music. So people still listen to conventional radio, they still buy CDs. That is changing, and the market is starting to uptick after a bit of a downturn. I expect that will continue to grow, and the sort of Christian music industry will get even greater. So tell me why we're divided.
And a couple of quick ones for you before we leave you, Ed. When I think of musicians that have grappled with faith or lack of it or struggling to come to terms with having it and having lost it, I think of some of the best songwriters of all time. I think of Johnny Cash, I think of Bob Dylan, I think of Nick Cave, who you would not regard as Christian musicians. Bob Dylan, obviously a very interesting example. These are people that have written wonderful songs about these topics. How good was the lyrical content of the stuff you saw? How good was the actual music?
It was good. I mean, it depends how you take it. If you look at the lyrical content or you look at the musicianship in terms of, you know, way they play the guitar, etc. What's interesting is that, you know, I perhaps expected all of the lyrics to be explicitly referencing God and Jesus, and that's not necessarily the case. It really, again, it depends on the type of music, like we talked about, the different kind of subgenres, if you like, within Christian music. I mean, in worship music, as I said before, is the most explicitly praiseworthy, and so that is perhaps not for everyone. What's fascinating for me was that some of the hip-hop I listened to was almost impossible to differentiate from normal hip-hop, except, of course, you didn't hear any swearing. But also, you know, I was trying to listen to the lyrics and sort of work out how this was religious music, and actually you had to listen very carefully. It wasn't explicit necessarily. It was more about lifestyle. Again, this is about presenting a certain way of life. So that was the interesting thing, and I think that's where there's so much potential, because it's, yes, it's clean, but it's still like fun, it's still interesting, it's still great musicianship, it's got still got great, you know, lyrical styling. And so there's no reason why that can't grow beyond this kind of Christian niche. It merely sort of gives across this sort of way of living. So that is the most fascinating area, the kind of area that I think could grow so much, because, you know, we talk about Christian rock and there's still a lot of, as a sort of generic term, for all these types of different musics. And in a way, kind of rock, heavy rock, there's still some bands out there, but it's more kind of, in a way, a 90s thing, isn't it? Rock has got less popular. If you look at young teenagers in the US, the UK, wherever, they're not, their music of rebellion isn't so much rock anymore. It's hip-hop. And so it's interesting to see how this Christian hip-hop is going to grow. I mean, there's one Word, which is one of the biggest Christian labels alongside CCMG, you know, started its own label specifically focused on hip-hop. There's another label in Atlanta that just does Christian hip-hop as well. So I think that's a potential growth area, and it'll be really interesting to see where that goes as well in the future.
Well, sounds like another a great follow-up story in a couple of years. We'll follow you down the road to Atlanta, Ed, and see how the Christian hip-hop scene is going. That was Ed the Gospel Stocker, reporting from mostly Nashville. Ed, thank you very much as ever.
So, Father God, I pray that our families will come together right now and seek your face. You will forgive our sins and you will heal.
While Nashville is in full swing, things are a little more peaceful in upstate New York, which is where we're heading now, for it's the part-time home of our next subject. Gary Hume was a central figure in art in the 1990s, and still is now. He was one of the YBAs, who now splits his time between his studios in New York and East London. Ahead of his new show at the newly spruced Spruitmagers Gallery in London, we catch up with him in the new issue of the magazine to discuss being an immigrant, the pressures of making art, and the subject of his new body of work, his mum. The story is shot in his studios on both sides of the pond, and taking the pictures in New York was the photographer Nathan Perkle. So what happens when someone who works in visuals photographs a visual artist? I spoke to Nathan to find out more about life behind the lens.
For the most part, it's usually a collaborative thing, and I tend to go in and try to have a little conversation for a while and then leave each other alone for, you know, maybe 30 minutes or so. And I'll just kind of wander around the space and kind of be a fly on the wall as long as I think is necessary to get a sense of the vibe of the place. And then that way I can kind of suss out the person. And so I can plan for how I'm going to take a portrait of them, because I tend to do that last unless there's some kind of time constraint. Just since it's better to kind of live in the same space for a minute, get used to each other, and I can kind of figure out what space will work for them, and also kind of like how far I can, you know, what kind of boundaries there might be with the portrait, or kind of sort out how I can show them.
So practically speaking, Nathan, you do the details first. You do the bit that actually some of our readers and listeners might think that you do the portrait first because it appears first in the magazine, you know, the holding shot of the person in question, the Gary Hume in this case, and then you do the details to sort of fill in the gaps. But actually, you've got an interesting way of working. You shoot the paintbrushes in the pot, the canvases on the walls, the little bits and pieces of detail that make up the character of the artist. And then you kind of stalk your prey slowly and then you go in for the kill at the end sort of thing. So you're sort of sussing each other out. There's a little bit of a dance.
Yeah, that was kind of that's definitely how I handled this and how I handle most of these kind of things. Like I'll walk around and kind of give each other a bit of space. And then I also like to let the person I'm photographing work on something. And then once I've kind of walked around for a while, I'll like slowly kind of like pop in and be a bit voyeuristic and photograph them working on something and then slowly kind of move in and then just like naturally like, okay, like what if we like go over here? And then try not to make it too formal. I mean, it depends on the person. Like if someone is extremely shy, then I'd probably shoot more like voyeuristic photos of them than the formal portraits. But yeah, it's like start with photographing the space and then slowly tippy-toe in and eventually make my presence known, I guess.
Now, the story opens, a story called Hume with a View, by the way, a little bit of a naff headline there. No work of yours, Nathan, you're not to blame for that, don't worry. Opens with a lovely portrait of yours of Gary Hume. And obviously, I guess there were a few to choose from. It was a job done between you and our photo editing team. But what are you looking for in a portrait? Obviously, you're looking for something to start off the story. That's often a portrait of the artist, so you know who they are, what they look like, kind of what their vibe is a bit. Is that something that you know you kind of have to get in the bag? You need that thing that you're trying to uncover a little bit of the wherewithal, dare I say it, the soul of the person, and that you kind of need to get one in the bag.
I usually will know when it's done, but I won't think to myself, like, this is the one image, that's the one. It's like, it all is just like this, it's like a Rolodex or something just spinning of all the images, and I just kind of like, that feels about right, you know? And also, a lot of it has to do with the subject. Like, if the subject is extremely shy, then, and I hate to use the word, I'll kind of like push them to like keep going, and it's like, one more thing, oh, what about this? Oh, put this in your hand, you know, like, and I'll kind of prompt them to do things. And then, like, see how far I can take it until they just don't want anymore. And, you know, there's been times when I've literally had people, like, stop. It's time to go, you know, like, and that's totally fine. And I'm fine with that. Like, I'm totally used to that kind of rejection, that one-on-one rejection like that. That, yeah, it can be a little daunting at times, especially if the person's, you know, a little aggressive. But, you know, like, for instance, like, if you're photographing people on the street and you want to have eye contact, it's inherent that you're going to talk to them and you're going to get rejected a bunch. And that's something that I do a lot. Like every day I'm walking around, I'll stop people on the street. I'll get rejected like every day with something. So like I could care less. Like if someone, you know, or not that I could care less, but I can live with that. With someone telling me like, no, like you're offending me. It's like, okay, I can back off and then, you know, shake hands and let them go about their day. And I might even ask them again, just because like, there might be something that I feel like I really need or I want that like would make the story or the portrait better. So Gary was awesome because we'd kind of lived in this space together for a while. And then I had come up with like four or five ideas. And then once we were doing those, I could kind of sense it was kind of coming to an end. Like he had some plans for the day and I didn't want to go into his day too much. But I definitely was like, oh, well, this, like, as we're shooting something, like, I thought this other thing, something else that I'd seen in the background would work. So like, what if we do this? And I kind of, we tried to prompt to go along with the whole thing, prompt him to go along with, you know, a couple more ideas until it seemed like it was time to drive home. So you just have to get used to having a little bit of rejection in the shoot at times and staying true to like the gut feeling of when you've gotten the amount of images that you think will work for the story.
And just finally, Nathan, is there a kind of go-to thing? Is there, if the character that you're photographing is shy, do you have to be lively to make up for them? Or do you kind of, do you, you know, as I called it kind of a dance before, do you have to kind of You have to be the opposite of the person you're photographing, or do you have to kind of be on very much on their wavelength to bring out the best in them? I mean, a lot of the time, I presume it's quite easy. People know what's sort of expected of them, and they sit there and they put their best shirt on and, you know, try not to smile too cheesily for the likes of Monocle, I suppose. But they kind of know what's expected of them. When someone's shy, do you sometimes find that you get a better picture out of the people you thought you weren't going to get a great photograph out of, because you've kind of melted something in them a little bit and you've made them come out of themselves a bit? This is photography as therapy, Nathan. That's what I'm talking about here.
I'm a licensed therapist as well.
Wow.
No, not really.
You just have to really have a sense of people and read people's body language and just really listen to people and like pay attention to them. I think that's like the most important part of being a photographer is to listen and to really be aware of everything going on. You know, like, I'm not the type of person to spend the entire shoot just like hammering ideas into someone's head of like, we're gonna do this and this and this. It's like, it's really, you're gonna have like such a lopsided view on things if you go into something with like a checklist of things, you don't allow some natural kind of magic to happen, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, I think that one of my pleasures of photography, as well as one of my kind of talents, I'd like to think, is that I really love to just listen to people and talk to them. And so I think that really like helps navigate every shoot of, you know, to try to connect with everybody. You know, I want to walk away and give the person I photographed a hug and like to both walk away like with high spirits, you know. So yeah, I mean, you just have to listen to people.
That was Nathan Perkle, whose photographs you can see in our interview with Gary Hume in the culture section of this month's Monocle. And if you flick to the back of the magazine, you'll find our inventory pages, which contain our travel, retail and culture picks of the month. For October, I've recommended a few albums to add to your collection, and one of them is by the Norwegian art pop band Broen. The Five Piece will release their debut LP, I Love Art, on October the 20th, and it's a fine thing to listen to. Broen from jazz, R&B, pop rock and electronica in one big Nordic package. Band member Lars Fossheim shot the breeze with producer Holly.
It's an idea of bringing art back to music or to pop music. I think it first came up as an idea from our tuba player Haida to kind of look back in time, but also forward, as how art has affected popular music throughout the years, and it certainly affected us. So I think we wanted to kind of incorporate that in our music.
You're putting your album out with Bella Union. How did you get involved with them?
It was actually Simon Raymond, the founder of the label, who sent us an email. We had sent the album out to different labels, but we had Bella Union on the top of our list. But he eventually listened to it, and then he was with us at once. So he said, "I'm on board. Let's work together."
Well, that must be an exciting feeling when the person at the top of your list wants to put your album out, right?
Yes. Yeah. Me and Hans, the drummer, we were hiking in one of the Norway's national parks, actually. And Haida called him and said that Bella Union wanted to work with us. And we were in the middle of nowhere. And we just started jumping and screaming because we were so happy. I think the moose kind of like went, well, what's this? What's happening here?
Of things you never knew, just 'cause you never bothered to.
You never hold me when you're on the album. It's like electronica, jazz, pop, R&B, funk, rock. There's a bit of everything. How do you know when one of your songs is finished? Because it's got so many layers.
That's a good question. I think we have a place where we want the song to be when we record it, but live it's a whole different story. Because the songs that we make, we usually play them and play them live, and then they're not finished. But through the course of, say, a couple of months or half a year, we've played the songs over and over and evolved them and changed them. And then we might record it and then we go on and playing it again, and then we're changing it over again. So it's always kind of evolving. Not that we're not satisfied with the way it sounds, but it's just, it's natural for us to keep on evolving something and keep on working on something.
But I think that's the nice thing about playing a song live, is that you can still change it up a bit and make it different every time you play it. And that's what's exciting about going to see a live band.
Yeah, that's essential of hearing music live, because I don't know, a lot of the music that comes from, well, all over the world now is based on tracks and based on a playback thing, you know, they're having pre-played tracks that they perform with live. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but for us it's not that really that interesting, because I think the thing that happens live when we play together, and it happens just there, that's the it's different from every time, and that's the thing with live music or play interplay that's really important to keep.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's nice for the audience because you get to see how the band work together, but it's also nice for the band because it means that every night's different, right?
Yeah, and it's for us, it's so big. It's such a big part of our process as well, you know, the way we work on our music. So it's essential.
I also just wanted to ask you about your live shows, because I've heard that they are something to behold. I mean, you've got a band full of visual artists, and I hear that you kind of go all out with masks and visuals and makeup.
Yeah, it started out with wearing sequin-covered suits that the grandma of Haida made for us, but we kind of evolved it, and it's just, for us, it's a important part of the whole thing with Rowan. It's quite important for us to have a visual profile that's, yeah, kind of reflects the different personalities of the band and the music. Now Haida, she's been the designer of her costumes now, so we've moved away from the sequins and we've gone to different types of costumes. But Haida, she's been making these new outfits for us, sewing them in her living room. So yeah, if you should come and see it, it's quite nice.
Well, to get a good look at those costumes for yourself, check out Broen as they tour Europe this autumn. Dates are available at bellunion.com, the band's label, and the album I Love Art is out on October the 20th. And that brings us to the end of today's show. For more on all of our stories today, make sure you pick up issue 107 of Monocle, which is available to buy or subscribe to now. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was, of course, Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Tune in at the same time next week, but for the time being, thanks for tuning in.